This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. North Carolina's voting laws are the subject of a federal trial in Winston-Salem, which is drawing national attention as well as protests. The changes in the state's voting laws have been controversial since before they were passed, and the outcome of this trial could potentially affect similar voting law changes elsewhere in the country. A group of plaintiffs, including the U.S. Department of Justice, the NAACP, and the League of Women Voters, are suing the state, arguing that these voting law changes violate the Voting Rights Act of 1965. Today, a discussion of the changes, the reasons put forth for those changes, how they allegedly violate the Voting Rights Act, the potential outcome of the trial, and the impact that outcome may have on voting, on other states' voting laws, and more. We're joined in Chapel Hill by Ted Shaw, the Julius L. Chambers Distinguished Professor of Law and Director of the Center for Civil Rights at the University of North Carolina's School of Law. He joins us from Chapel Hill. Welcome.
Thank you and good morning.
Good morning. Hans von Spakovsky, is Senior Legal Fellow and Manager of the Election Law Reform Initiative in the Center for Legal and Judicial Studies at the Heritage Foundation. He joins us by phone from Washington. Thank you for being with us.
Thanks, Mike.
And here in our studio is WFAE's Michael Tomczyk, who has been following this story as it has developed over the last several years for WFAE News. And let me begin with you, Michael. The federal trial started last Monday, not this past one, but the Monday before last in Winston-Salem. Other states have passed similar voting laws, perhaps not as severe or as far-reaching as ours. But why are we the site for this case?
Well, this one is specifically about the North Carolina changes. So the Justice Department has decided to challenge, I think as of right now, there are two different state changes it's challenging. One was in Texas involving just a voter ID change. They specifically decided to come challenge North Carolina's because of the sweep. It was cuts to early voting, getting rid of same-day registration during early voting, no longer counting ballots that were cast in the wrong precinct. They are also challenging the ID provision, but that's not part of the current trial. Basically, the arguments on that will come at a later point.
We'll talk about why that is, because that seems to be one of the prickly points for a lot of people. What's at stake here?
How we vote. I mean, literally, if you in North Carolina will have 17 days versus 10 days of early voting. If you in North Carolina will be able to register to vote on the same day as you vote during early voting. If you in North Carolina accidentally, you know, for whatever reason are confused about what precinct you're supposed to vote in, if you vote in the wrong precinct, whether that ballot is counted or thrown out, and then down the line, the ID part.
I'd like to hear from Ted Shaw and Hans von Spakovsky about this next question. The lawyer representing the North Carolina NAACP said in court, "This is our Selma." Marchers outside the courthouse on that very first day of the trial last week echoed that sentiment. Are they exaggerating? Is that a fair statement? Is this, as the plaintiffs say, a pivotal moment in North Carolina and United States history? I'll begin with you, Ted Shaw.
Well, it certainly is an important, if not pivotal, moment in North Carolina. Whether it is in the country remains to be seen, but the country is watching this. And this law, as you've indicated, is the most sweeping with respect to the cutbacks on the provisions that made the ballot more accessible. I would just add that it's not only a question of how we vote, it's a question of whether we vote, because I think it's pretty clear that these provisions were adopted with the goal of trying to push some people out of the democratic process. I'm sure that Hans is going to deny that, but it's one of those moments where you say, "Don't tell me it's raining," you know the rest mm-hmm. of that saying. So it's a crucial moment.
So is it a pivotal moment? Is it another Selma, Hans von Spakovsky?
No, that is an exaggeration that is just completely untrue. I mean, let's talk about this very specifically. I mean, for example, the state got rid of same-day registration. Well, look, the majority of states do not have same-day registration. In fact, only a small number of states across the country have same-day registration, and the reason is very simple. When somebody registers and immediately votes, there's no time for election officials to actually check and verify the accuracy of the voter registration information that they're given. The state put in a very reasonable 25 days. You have to register before. That matches what many, many other states do. There's nothing unreasonable about that. Same thing with early voting. Early voting is a relatively new phenomenon. There are many states that don't have early voting. And yet what they're basically saying in this lawsuit is if you as a state have not adopted early voting, if you still insist on one day of election, which has been the tradition of this country for over 200 years, well, then somehow you're violating the Voting Rights Act. The other thing about this is, look, the experts in this case, the Justice Department, the NAACP, all have said, oh, well, the effect of this is going to be to depress turnout, to suppress the votes. Well, we know that's not true because guess what? We've got the turnout data now from the 2014 election. Because remember, the judge in this case refused to issue an injunction. So all of these changes, with the exception of the voter ID law, these were in place in the 2014 election. And what's remarkable is that North Carolina is one of the few states in which turnout went up in 2014. In the rest of the country, turnout went down in comparison to the 2010 election. In North Carolina, it actually went up, and the turnout of black voters increased by almost 30% over the 2010 election in the primary. Mm-hmm. In the general election, it also went up, including the black share of votes went up over the 2010 election. So we know that all these claims that would somehow keep people out of the polls, that's not true.
Michael?
I will jump in with the turnout numbers. If you look at the rates, they went up slightly. The numbers overall look bigger. So the 30% that Hans mentioned on African-American turnout, that's in raw numbers. If you look at the turnout rate, so basically, you know, we're a growing state. We have a bigger population in 2014 than we did in 2010. It's a much, much smaller increase. But it did increase. And that's been a key argument that the state's attorneys have raised in court. If this is going to be, you know, the way the NAACP has described it, is a monster voter suppression bill, the state's attorneys in court have been like, well, if that's the case, how come there wasn't all this chaos? How come there weren't all these problems in 2014? Now, of course, the plaintiffs counter with, well, we are bringing in all of these witnesses to explain how, because of these new changes, they were not able to vote.
Let's have a little history lesson here. Historically,
Let me just say one other thing, though. There is, in reaction to this this legislation that was aimed at changing the dynamic with respect to the vote in North Carolina, there is a movement that has started, and you certainly have had many people react to this by making sure that they go to the polls. That doesn't make the laws that were passed either prudent or fair in any way. If Hans wants to be back 200 years ago with respect to how we vote, then, you know, that doesn't commend itself very highly.
Hold on. We're not going back 200 years. In fairness, in 2000, state lawmakers opened up early voting. In 2005, they said that voters could cast ballots outside of their assigned precinct. In 2007, they allowed same-day registration. What impact did that have on voters? What did it have on voting by African Americans and others?
This is a crucial part of the case. When you look at the numbers, historically, you know, going way back, African American turnout has been far, far below whites. African American voter registration mm-hmm. has been far below whites. In the 2000s, you know, around the time of these changes, that really started to turn around and built to the point, you know, big increase in African American turnout to 2004. Much bigger in 2008 and 2012, to the point that in 2008 and 2012, African Americans disproportionately used those things that were put into place. And for the first time, potentially since, you know, the 1800s, the 1890s, the 1890s maybe, actually had their turnout rates match that of white turnout. So that's been a big argument here. These are things that, you know, under the old regime, helped to fix somewhat this disparity, and then they were curtailed or removed.
So these changes in 2000, 2005, 2007 were meant to address the disparities in voting rates that had been historical in North Carolina. Is that why they were put in?
Not necessarily. Out of precinct voting, when it was passed in 2005, there was a specific line in the bill that that said, we know that African Americans have disproportionately used this. So that was the thought on that. I think as far as early voting and same-day registration, the idea really was simpler, which is let's make it easier to vote.
Now, a lot of the changes, at least the reasons given for the changes, were to decrease voter fraud. Is that accurate? Is that why the legislature put these changes in?
That has been the most consistent line that they have used. They haven't you really can't find a whole lot of explanation for this. When the bill was ultimately passed, it was pretty much rammed through at the end of the session. The consistent themes we have heard, yes, that is one, voter fraud. Also, as far as the early voting changes, you'll hear originally, it was going to just be cut to 10 days, period. They amended it so that we're going to cut it by a week, but still require the same total number of hours. So basically, that means polling sites have to be open longer during mm-hmm. that shorter early voting period. So some of the lawmakers who have defended that part, at least, have said, well, we think this will actually help because if you have work, you have these longer hours.
So if it's not voter fraud, and voter ID, the photo ID part of this, which is not part of this trial, was certainly pointed to as something that would reduce voter fraud because your picture's on your voter ID.
Right.
If it's not voter fraud, is it politics? Is it stuffing the ballot box with people who are more likely to vote for your party?
Well, politics has actually been another reason that the state's attorneys have pointed to in court. They say, those changes in the 2000, who was in power then? Democrats. Mm-hmm. Who's in power now? Republicans. Mm-hmm. How do you know this isn't just, you know, a different party having a different view of how elections should be conducted?
Ted Shaw, how do you see this?
Well, clearly it's politics to the extent that the Republicans who are in power now want to stay in power. And right, when Democrats are in power, they want to stay in power. I think we ought to be asking the question of democracy. How do we get participation in democracy? And in this country, we make it much more difficult to vote than many other countries do. The issue of voter fraud has been described as a solution in search of a problem. There's just not much documented voter fraud, certainly in-person voter fraud, mm-hmm. That would necessitate these kinds of cutbacks. But I think we, regardless of race, regardless of partisanship, and in this country, sadly, right now, and for some time, it's been difficult to tease out those two things. We ought to be asking, how can we maximize the opportunity for citizens to vote, regardless of what party they're in, what race, whatever identification they may carry, with respect to who they are and what they are. I think this is about the core and the heart of democracy, and clearly some people are trying to push other people out of participation in the electoral process.
I have 20 seconds. Would you disagree with that, Hans?
I disagree completely with that. And the idea that we make it more difficult to vote than other countries is completely wrong. We're one of the only countries of Western democracies that doesn't require voter ID. And by the way, there's a number of studies out that say that early voting actually does not increase turnout. It may hurt turnout.
We have to take a break. We'll come back with more of this discussion in just a moment. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Rayburn, Cooper & Durham, professional counsel on commercial litigation matters. Rayburn, Cooper & Durham, serving Charlotte's business community since 1988. More information at rcdlaw.net. Individuals, families, even corporations can all operate more sustainably. What about a whole university? In fact, a university system. Well, a couple of weeks ago, we were going to talk about this, and we had a technical issue. So tomorrow, we are going to talk about this. Appalachian Washington State has set out to build a sustainable system campus-wide, and for the last 4 years, or actually 5 years now, has hosted a summit for the entire University of North Carolina system and others to learn about sustainable practices. They just held their last gathering. We sit down with some key players to find out how this might work and what it would mean tomorrow morning at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, more than 4,000 scientists from around the world meet in Washington this week to share the latest research on diagnosing, treating, and preventing Alzheimer's. New findings on the role of race, gender, and a sedentary lifestyle.
Join the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the voting laws that are on trial, essentially, in North Carolina in Winston-Salem, which began last Monday with Ted Shaw, the Julius L. Chambers Distinguished Professor of Law and Director for the Center for Civil Rights at the University of North Carolina Law School, or School of Law. Hans von Spakovsky is the Senior Legal Fellow and Manager of Election Reform Initiative at the Center for Legal and Judicial Studies at the Heritage Foundation, and Michael Tomczyk has been covering this unfolding case since the laws were passed several years ago for WFAE News. I don't want to spend a lot more time on the intent of these laws, but I think that's part of all of this. And Morgan Kusser, who is from the California Institute of Technology, was called as an expert witness on legislative intent. And one way that he studies intent is to look at what happened before things take place, before laws are passed. And he says that the thing that happened here was the surge in black voting, and then all of the things that led to black voting were taken away by these new laws. Does that make the state's claim that the changes are race neutral seem less plausible, Hans?
That is just completely wrong. And let me point something out. The experts brought in by the Justice Department said something in their testimony that I think, quite frankly, is racist. I mean, it's the soft bigotry of low expectations. The experts say that African-Americans voters would be negatively affected by these changes, like reducing the early voting times, because they are, quote, less sophisticated voters. And here's another quote. It's less likely to imagine that these voters can figure out or would avail themselves of other forms of registering and voting. I totally reject the idea that black voters are somehow dumber than other voters. I mean, that is the racist kind of testimony that they are putting in this case. And we know it's not true. I got to emphasize this again, because these changes were in effect last year. The percentage of blacks voting went up in comparison to the voting age population. By all measures, the number of voters actually went up. And that plays in with what I said right before the break, which is, look, there's a number of studies. People don't have to believe me. There's a number of studies out that have looked at early voting. And I know this is counterintuitive, but a good report from the University of Wisconsin just last year, in which they said that early voting, according to these professors, actually hurts turnout as much as 3 or 4%. And I know that's counterintuitive, but look what happened in North Carolina. They actually reduced the number of early voting days, even though they kept the hours the same, and you had a big increase in turnout in comparison to the last midterm election, the opposite of what happened in the rest of the country when turnout went down.
So, Ted Shaw, some of those things do sound racist. Do they sound racist to you?
I think it's a misstatement of what's being said. And
I quoted exactly the language from the transcript of the expert.
Okay. And I think what Morgan Kausa is talking about, what others have talked about, is the way in which a lot of voters who are African American, and we can just look at the statistics. It's not a question of them being dumb. It's a question of whether or not the various mechanisms that are being put in place, the complicated rules about where one can vote, when one can vote, whether or not people are easily able to track that, whether they have access to that information easily, the turnout that Hans keeps talking about in 2014, I would contend, is the consequence of a very powerful reaction to these attempts to deny the right to vote or to make it more difficult to vote. And so people did turn out. But it doesn't mean that the policies and practices that were put in place were excusable or appropriate in any way. Look, part of voting rights law, and Hans knows this because he's been at this for a while, looks at, we look at the Voting Rights Act and the case law that's been applied, looks at the level of education of voters. You take those things into account for certain purposes. And, you know, the levels of education that African-American voters have is unfortunately lower. That's not a racist statement. I'm an African-American, but we look at the facts about who's had access to education, who's gone further. It doesn't have anything to do with whether they're dumb. It's a question of opportunity.
And that's a key distinction that the witnesses have made as they have been testifying in court. It's not so much just because they are African-American, this or that. It's when you look at the historical disparity in North Carolina, there are countless metrics that show from an educational achievement standpoint, from an economic well-being standpoint, in large part because of the history of racial discrimination that was official across the South, there is still this disparity between how African-Americans are doing and how white voters are doing. And what the experts have been arguing in court is because of that disparity, mm-hmm. because that is a reality, you know, phrases like low literacy voters, phrases like the one that Hans mentioned, you know, it's more likely that African-Americans, because of these economic disparities, are going to have a more difficult time finding the information or complying with changes.
The voting law changes in North Carolina and those that also took place in Ohio and other states that are watching this trial closely, like Wisconsin, these were passed just after the Supreme Court struck down a section of the Voting Rights Act that required some jurisdictions to seek approval from the federal government before altering their laws. Most of those areas were in the South, North Carolina among them. We had been found to have had voting practices in the past that disenfranchised minorities, so we were under that order. Is this an example of reverting to that policy as quickly as possible in the absence of federal restrictions? We don't have to get permission anymore, so we're going back to the old way of doing business?
Well, let me say one clarification. One clarification. One clarification. The part of the Voting Rights Act that was struck down was actually not Section 5, which is the law that required preclearance by jurisdictions with a history of discrimination and electoral practices, but it was the kind of operating mechanism, the formula for determining who was covered, the coverage mechanism, Section 4. So just want to be clear on that. Okay. But if Section 4 had still been in place and Section 5 still had, therefore, its strength, these kinds of changes would have been subject to preclearance by either the Justice Department or the District Court for the District of Columbia.
So what you're saying is
it is no coincidence that this happened immediately after the Shelby case was decided, versus Holder.
So what you're saying is that these law changes could not have been made without seeking permission from the federal government had the statute remained completely intact, correct?
That's right.
So what's the likelihood of the federal government to saying yes to these changes had those things stayed intact? What's the likelihood of these even being proposed had they stayed intact?
Well, wait a minute now. Let's be clear here. Okay, the first voter ID laws requiring a government-issued photo ID were passed in 2005, okay, in places like Georgia, which had to go through Section 5 preclearance.
Mm-hmm.
Voter ID law was passed by a ballot referendum in Arizona, also in the 2004 election, which had to go through Section 5 preclearance. A South Carolina law was passed when the Section 5 preclearance requirement was in place. And I would remind folks that, in fact, the Justice Department tried to object under Section 5 to the South Carolina voter ID law, and a federal court said that they were wrong. And so the South Carolina voter ID law is in place today, as is the law in Georgia, which has been in place now for 8 years. We have turnout data from election after election after election, and all the predictions being made by the experts currently testifying, and the experts last year have all proven to be untrue. It has not prevented African Americans and Hispanics or others from voting in Georgia. In fact, they've had almost no problems with these statutes in place.
Two things, Mike. First, to answer your question, would this law have been proposed if not for the change? The answer is no, and that's because the Republicans behind the law said as much. The day after the U.S. Supreme Court made that decision, mm-hmm. One of the higher-ups in the Republican caucus in the Senate goes, we can go with the full bill now. What went from a roughly 14-page bill in the House that the House passed that had hearings that people, you know, had strong opinions on, but even the Democratic lawmakers involved thought this was a decent process, at least. It was a 14-page bill, just about ID. The House passed it. The Senate sat on it till after that Supreme Court decision, then waited a little bit. It was like another month or two. And at the very end of the session, all of a sudden, a substitute for that 14-page bill was 57 pages and included this wide, wide sweeping changes. And that is a key distinction between North Carolina and some of the other states that we're hearing about, because, the Justice Department has even argued in court. We're not saying just explicitly, if you cut your early voting period, we're going to come and fight that. That's been one of the key questions, because the judge in this case has asked, well, if I say this is unconstitutional here, there are lots of states that don't have early voting. Is it unconstitutional there? And what the Justice Department has said is, so Georgia, for example, a couple of years ago, Georgia greatly reduced its early voting period, but there was bipartisan support for those changes. There were African-American lawmakers who were in favor of those changes. So the Justice Department said, in that case, we're okay with it. What they're trying to say is, this specific North Carolina, these specific changes, because of how much African Americans have come to rely on some of these changes, that's why we're challenging here.
The photo ID part of this legislation was the prickly part. This is one that got a lot of people's attention before all the other things about the bill came out. And yet the photo ID portion of this is not on trial here. Why not?
Because of a last-minute change. So last month, shortly before the trial began, lawmakers near unanimously passed this change to create bigger fail-safes. So if you don't have an ID, you can sign an affidavit saying, you know, you are who you are. There are different ways you can show you are who you are. Basically, the simplest way to put it is it made it way less strict. And so as the attorneys on both sides have been researching their arguments on what this ID provision will do, well, if all of a sudden that ID provision is very different, they ask the judge for more time to figure out how that fits into their case, and the judge granted them that time.
This trial, as we've said, is going to focus on early voting, same-day registration, and out-of-precinct changes, where you used to be able to vote out of precinct. Professor Shaw, in what way might those changes, in your view, violate the Voting Rights Act of 1965?
Well, it's not just a question of whether they on their face violate the Voting Rights Act. I think the problem here has been that these kinds of opportunities to vote were adopted. They were successful. And the argument is that the reason that they've been cut back or eliminated is because the legislature or some of those in charge these days are trying to push people out because of their race or the way their race coincides with partisan politics. It may not be that they are simply racist, but there is a connection between race and partisanship, as I mentioned before. But if that's right, if I'm right about that, and if the plaintiffs are right about that, then that constitutes a form of discrimination. That is to say, it's because of the effect on African-American voters that these policies were adopted. One of the things that is so frustrating in this discourse is this supposition that this has nothing to do with pushing people out of the political process. I think about my own grandmother, who all her life, I remember she was trying to get her birth certificate, and she couldn't get it. She could never find it, in part because the courthouse apparently had a fire years and years ago, and so it wasn't available. American born, American all her life. She only stepped out of the United States for a moment once in her life, and she would not be able to vote under some of these laws unless we have some kinds of measures that mitigate the impact of these laws.
Hans, when these laws were first being discussed, I remember having a discussion on this program with several people about this not being necessarily racial, but certainly affecting people of lower economic class who have hourly jobs, who are really restricted in how much free time they have, who may not have ready access to transportation, who would be at the whims of that transportation and being able to find it and being able to get off work to go and vote. And so that early voting and a long period of early voting actually gave them more opportunity to vote, be they black or white or Hispanic, whatever.
And I'm telling you, the turnout data does not show that to be true. Okay, I don't want to keep repeating myself.
But why put up the roadblock anyway? What difference does it make?
Early voting actually may hurt turnout, according to academics who've looked at it.
But it hurts. Would it hurt voter?
Hold on for just a breath.
If it hurts early voting turnout, is that because people decide I'm not going to vote, or is it because why else would it be?
It's easy. I'll tell you why, and here's what the experts speculate on. The problem with early voting is this. Campaigns spend a huge amount of money, as you all very well know, on get-out-the-vote campaigns, and that effort is very intense right before Election Day. What people believe is that when you have to spread out that effort over several weeks, or even a month, it is not the intensity of it isn't as effective. And because of that, you have this small percentage, these professors estimate 3-4% of it actually hurting turnout. And I would also point out, look, the Census Bureau does surveys after federal elections of non-voters. And this idea that people don't vote because they have problems getting registered or they can't get to the polls, the surveys don't show that. What the survey shows, done by the federal government, is that non-voters say the reason they don't vote is because they're not interested in politics, they're not interested in the campaigns, they don't like the candidates. It has nothing to do with these kind of administrative, physical issues of not being able to get to the polls. That is a tiny, tiny percentage of the survey. Again, people don't have to believe me. These surveys are easily available, and they can find them. It's people not being interested in the election process. Look, you get
with all due respect, there are thousands and thousands of African Americans and others who are marching in the streets of North Carolina about these issues for the right to vote. I mean, to suggest that people aren't interested in voting, that's baffling at best.
The survey explains why people who don't vote and are asked about it by the Census Bureau. These are the reasons they give for not voting. And by the way, I should say, on voter ID, for example, you can look at the polling on this, and it doesn't matter whether you look at the Washington Post polling, Rasmussen polling, a majority of Americans, including a majority of African Americans, believe that voter ID is a common sense, good idea. They do not agree with their so-called leaders.
But voter ID is not on trial here. The other three aspects of this are.
I understand, but we're talking about a lot of different issues here. And my point is,
and I'd be happy to talk about voter ID.
The studies show that early voting actually may hurt turnout. And in North Carolina last year, when the early voting days reduced, turnout went up in comparison to the rest of the country.
Let me stop you there. We have to take a break. We'll get your reaction to that, Ted Shaw, in a moment. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Relevant Sports, exhibiting the International Champions Cup presented by Guinness. The French champions Paris Saint-Germain meet English champions Chelsea FC Saturday at Bank of America Stadium. Tickets at Ticketmaster.com. More than 4,000 scientists from around the world meet in Washington, D.C. this week to share the latest research on diagnosing, treating, and preventing Alzheimer's. So on the Diane Rehm Show in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock, they will take a look at new findings on the role of race, gender, and a sedentary lifestyle on all of this. That's coming up in 20 minutes. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can email us at charlottetalks@wfae.org, or you can search for WFAE on Facebook or Twitter. That will get you to us, and we are coming right back.
I listen to Bullseye because it gives me all the information on things that I know I want to know about, but it also gives me inside information on things that I didn't even know I wanted to know about, such as music, arts, movies, people I should be connected with, people that I end up connecting with thanks to Bullseye.
Bullseye is your guide to what's good. From MaximumFun.org and NPR.
That's Saturdays at 8 at 90.7 WFAE and WFAE.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. A lot of call letters going back and forth here with Ted Shaw, Julius L. Chambers Distinguished Professor of Law and the Director for the Center for Civil Rights at the University of North Carolina School of Law. Hans von Spakovsky is Senior Legal Fellow with the Heritage Foundation, and Michael Tomczyk, a reporter for WFAE News. You wanted to make a point, Michael, about these two groups of people, those protesting outside of this trial who want these voter law changes, voter laws changed, and those who don't vote, who don't participate, don't care.
There can be both, was basically the point I wanted to make. I mean, if you look at, you know, our national turnout rates, they're way lower than a lot of other advanced countries. So yeah, I mean, clearly we have some percentage of people who aren't interested, for whatever reason aren't going to vote, whatever. But the existence of those people does not mean that there are not also people who desperately want to vote, who find these things really important, but because of their means, because of confusion, whatever, don't get a chance to actually go vote, or don't try to go vote, but then for whatever reason, their vote does not count. I mean, I've been watching in Winston-Salem as there have been more than a dozen witnesses called to tell their stories under oath about how they really wanted to vote, but because of this or that, they were unable to in the 2014 election.
Ted, I heard you say that although the voter ID portion of this, the photo ID portion of this law is not on the table in this trial, you wanted to comment on that. Go ahead and comment on that.
Well, let me say with all due respect to Hans' argument that many, if not the majority, of African-Americans and other Americans support voter ID laws. That I've seen some of those studies or reports. That doesn't mean that voter ID laws are either a good idea or whether they're fair. And a lot of people are not terribly well-informed, all Americans, about the merits of that debate. We assume that everybody has most of us, we have driver's licenses or some other form, passports, et cetera. I always think about what happened in New Orleans as Katrina came on and we all watched on television. We saw that long line of cars going across the bridge. It looked like everybody was getting out, and I think most people assumed everybody was getting out. And then we found out there were tens of thousands of people who were left behind because they were too poor. There are millions of Americans who don't have IDs, and disproportionately, because poverty has a lot to do with this, they're African-American or Latino. I would make a statement that may give some people some pause. Homeless people, if they're Americans, have the right to vote, period. And so this notion that there's this great problem with voter fraud, nobody has demonstrated that. I'm not sure that Hans even would say that he could demonstrate that, although maybe he will. I don't know.
Ted, I'd be happy to send you a copy of my book that demonstrates many cases of voter fraud across the country.
Well, Hans,
give me an address, I'll send you a copy.
Hans, prior to your present position, you served 2 years as a member of the Federal Election Commission. You worked at the Justice Department, providing expertise in enforcing the Voting Rights Act. At that time, did you witness or hear of verifiable cases of voter fraud, and to what degree, if so?
Oh, I know where this is going.
Yeah, I've written a book that goes through and demonstrates case after case of prosecutions all across the country of voter fraud. The Heritage Foundation, where I work, we're putting together a database of just recent cases. We've got, I think, 250 cases already on it in many parts of the country. And look, this idea, again, that this keeps people from voting, I'm sorry, but these ID laws have been in place now for many years in states like Indiana and Georgia. They have had no problems. In fact, look, just about a year and a half ago, I went and I looked up the names of the witnesses in the lawsuit that was filed by the NAACP against the Georgia voter ID law, they lost. But I went and I got the names of the witnesses, these people who testified in court that they didn't have an ID, they wouldn't be able to get one of the free IDs, they just wouldn't be able to get it, wouldn't be able to vote, and I checked their names with the Secretary of State in Georgia to see what their voting history was ever since the voter ID law became effective after the lawsuit was dismissed. And all these people who testified in court they'd never be able to get an ID, not only had gotten IDs, but had been voting in election after election.
Well, first of all, let me say something about this. I'm familiar with some of this, and this gets very complex. But, you know, there are people, for example, who have the name Gary Johnson, and it's a common name. Because it's a common name, you end up with the contention that somebody either voted where they weren't supposed to vote or somehow engaged in some kind of fraud. It's not the same person. So that I know that that I mean, now that Hans mentions it, yeah, I've heard of his book. But there are, you know, I think that this is much more complicated, and often the people who are supposed to be engaged in fraud are not. In fact, they're not even the same person. But in any event, I want to point to Judge Posner, a very well-respected judge on the Seventh Circuit who saw or sat on the panel that decided the Crawford case out of Indiana, which went to the Supreme Court a few years back, and he voted to uphold the voter ID law. He subsequently had said, after reflecting on this and coming to a better understanding of how these laws are working, that he would change his vote now. And others are beginning to realize that these laws are not only unnecessary, but they're unfair, and also that the intent with which they're adopted isn't as pure as these legislators and others have maintained.
Michael?
And I want to make a point on, on the idea of voter fraud. So there, if you look at just the North Carolina data, that's what I'm most familiar with. I mean, yes, there are some examples of voter fraud. It's not that it does not exist, period. However, when you look at, you know, even assuming that you know, people who registered their registration going unverified, which there can be reasonable, there can be reasons for that that are not fraud, you know, change of address, whatever. Even assuming that all of those examples in North Carolina actually are fraud, which is an assumption, it is a tiny, tiny, tiny percentage of the overall election, too small of a percentage to make any legitimate difference in a major federal race. So the idea that I think that this is one of the things that's been interesting to hear in court. The plaintiff's attorneys will argue the idea that a tiny percentage of fraud is a good enough reason to change election procedures that hundreds of thousands of North Carolinians have come to rely on, they view that as an unequal equation.
Let's talk about something else that we haven't really spent a lot of time on. That's out-of-precinct changes that were brought about by this law. There have been some arguments about that going on in the trial as well.
And that's another example of something that, that by the numbers is small. So there are not a ton of North Carolinians when we used to count out-of-precinct ballots who would vote out of precinct. But when you crunch the numbers on those who did, there's a disproportionate number who were African American. And this gets back to something that we've talked about a lot during this hour, which is if you are not as well off and they're, you know, because of the disparity we have racially, that's more likely to be African Americans in our state, you're less likely to know what your right precinct is. And sometimes there will be a precinct that is just, you know, down the street from you. That is not your precinct, and it can be confusing for some people when they walk to their precinct to then find out, oh, actually, you have to go way far away to figure out what, you know, what that's going to be. And we actually we have a little bit of an argument from a federal appeals court hearing last summer that was about whether we should put some of these changes on hold, where essentially you hear this play out. So a federal judge from North Carolina, his name was James Wynn, said counting out of precinct ballots would result in a lot of people voting who otherwise would have had their ballots tossed out. And here's how an attorney representing the state, Thomas Farr, responded.
That's an assumption that for which there's no evidence. You are looking at a statistical correlation.
An assumption that someone who walks into the wrong precinct and votes, that his vote won't count? That's not an assumption. You told me that's a reality.
Why did they go to that wrong precinct?
It could have been grandma's right there next door, but she walked over to the precinct. I don't want to give the answers to this, and you're right. There's no evidence grandma's going to do that. But we do have to use a little common sense here. We know this happens, and we do know
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Well, from past practices, there's evidence within the record that goes to the level of education disparity, the transportation disparity that exists for certain people, the moving around. There is confusion. You know, a lot of folks, if you'd ask them what precinct I vote in, I bet you they probably couldn't tell you sitting in this place right now. You got to really think about sometimes what precinct you are supposed to vote in. Mm-hmm.
So that was a federal judge, James Wynn, talking to the state's attorney, or an attorney representing the state, Thomas Farr. And it gets to the complexities of, you know, this one example of the overall argument that's going on. And the point, I think, essentially that judge was making, because he lives in North Carolina and knows where precincts can be based on where he lives, is that the easiest option under these changes is not necessarily the option that you have to vote.
But let's get to the crux of this. There are three things on trial here. One of them is early voting. Virginia doesn't have early voting. Something else, the out-of-precinct changes that we've been talking about, we just heard a cut about. The South Carolina does not have out-of-precinct voting. Why aren't those two states then out of compliance with the voter rights laws of 1965? If we possibly could be out of compliance because of these changes.
And the state's attorneys keep asking that question in court and making that point. They say, yeah, if you say that this is not okay in North Carolina, there are going to be all of these other states that need to change their laws. How the Justice Department responds to that is that it is about combining how much people have come to rely on this in this specific instance in this state. It's about how under these provisions you had turnout surge. It's about the history of discrimination that feeds into these disparities that creates a scenario where because of how these things are used in North Carolina, taking them away is the problem. All that said, I mean, clearly, as I've been in court, as you hear the judge asking questions to both sides about this, this is clearly something he struggles mm-hmm. with.
So is this why this is a pivotal moment in history, if it in fact is? Because if the court decides that we are not in compliance, does that mean that Virginia then has to have early voting? Does it mean that South Carolina?
No. Virginia is not at issue here. You know, we have to think about this as a question of whether the intent and the effect of what the North Carolina legislature has done is to push African Americans out, or some African Americans out of the process of being able to participate in democracy and in voting. So if this had never been adopted, maybe this question wouldn't be on the table, although some would be advocating for these kinds of changes. But once it was adopted and it turned out to work well and open up electoral opportunity for voters, then the legislature takes it away if its intent or effect is discriminatory. That's a problem. That doesn't have anything to do with what happens in Georgia or in Virginia or any other state.
U.S. Justice Department lawyer Catherine Mesa says that African Americans have come to rely on the ability to cast out-of-precinct ballots. But does reliance constitute constitutionality?
Not by itself.
It does not, and it's not a violation of the Voting Rights Act either. But look, Ted saying this only affects North Carolina. No, it doesn't. If the federal courts say that if you don't have early voting, enough of it, if you don't have same day registration, if you don't allow a ballot to be counted outside of your assigned precinct, if the federal courts say that there, civil rights groups and the Justice Department will use that decision to attack other states that don't have this. They may initially lose, but they're going to use this as a precedent. And look, the traditional rule in America has been, in every state, that you don't count ballots cast outside of an assigned precinct. It causes all kinds of problems. For example, it means that you're really only partially voting. Because if you're voting in another precinct, you may be in another legislative district, another city council district, so all the votes you cast to which you are in districts you're not assigned aren't going to count. We shouldn't be encouraging people to vote outside their precincts because that is not the right way to do things. It's not a good thing for the voters to do that. And that is a traditional way we've done it for a very long time. In every state, it has nothing to do with race. It has nothing to do with discrimination. They're trying to use the courts to put in place the election rules that, from a public policy standpoint, they think are the right ones. That's not the way to do it. You know, convince the legislature how to do this, convince local county boards how to do it. Don't use the courts to try to circumvent the legislative process on a public policy issue.
The legislature here in North Carolina had already done that.
Fine. Then work on getting people elected who will change it. This is not a court issue. It has nothing to do with discrimination or a violation of the voting rights.
Well, some say that no matter which way,
the parade of horribles didn't occur.
Some say that no matter which way the decision of this court goes, it will be challenged and may go all the way to the Supreme Court. Both sides may take a challenge on this. Is that what you see happening here?
Yeah.
Yes, absolutely. It already went up to the Supreme Court once.
Well, I think that's the one thing we can agree on, that there's a good chance, although anybody who's litigated these kinds of cases or civil rights cases or any other kind of cases would be a fool to predict that the court is sure to take it. But I think we agree that there's a good chance it may head there.
Ted Shaw is the Julius L. Chambers Distinguished Professor of Law and Director of the Center for Civil Rights at the UNC School of Law up in Chapel Hill. Hans von Spakovsky is Senior Legal Fellow and Manager of Election Reform Initiative at the Center for Legal and Judicial Studies at the Heritage Foundation. And Michael Tomczyk has been reporting on this and will continue to do so as the trial unfolds here for WFAE News. Thank you all for the hour.
Thanks, Mike.
Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins.